Hi, and welcome back to Ordinarily Extraordinary Conversations with Women in STEM. Before I get to introducing today's guest, I wanted to thank all of my podcast listeners, the people I've had on my podcast, this community that has built up over the last 3.5 years means so much to me. And I am so grateful to be able to host this podcast. It's honestly one of the funnest things that I've done in my career, and I just really appreciate all of my listeners. So thank you so much for being with me over this 3.5 years, or if you've just joined, thank you for being here just for this episode too. Anyway, on to today's guest. I am so excited for today's guest because we have a lot in common, and I get to talk about some of my passions, such as math and architecture. And we talk about political service and how that has become a huge passion for my guest. My guest has also worked in the utility industry for her entire career. When she retired, she decided to get involved in politics at the state level. She shares how she started on that journey and how public service is so important to her and enables her to fulfill her retirement passion of helping and serving others. Celeste Davis is the representative of the 100th District of the State House of Representatives for South Carolina. Prior to that, she spent 31 years at Santee Cooper, an electric and water utility in South Carolina, where she started out working in information technology and then moved into leadership positions in power supply. Celeste has a bachelor's degree in mathematics, hence the reason we talk about math, and a master's degree in computer and information systems management. I resonate with so much of what Celeste does and what we talk about in our conversation. She was just an absolute joy to get to know. I hope you enjoy her story.
Hi.
I'm glad to see you. How are you doing this morning?
Good to see you too. I'm doing well. Doing well. So I am not in my office. My office at the Capitol building, well, it's not in the Capitol building, it's the office building in that complex. The floor of the building is being renovated. And so we are all totally out of that floor. So that meant that I had to box up all of my stuff, and my stuff is stored here, yon, and everywhere. And so at this point, I don't have an office. I'm supposed to have an office starting January 1st. So everybody's working remotely, including me.
Okay. So let's start with, what is your job? Like, what do you currently do for a job?
What do I currently do? Mm-hmm. Well, I hate to even call it a job for a couple of reasons. Number one, I love it so much, and it's more like a calling than a job. Mm. And then two, because of the pay, because, you know.
You don't get paid much, I'm guessing, right?
Right. Yeah, so I hesitate to even call it a job for those couple of reasons. But, I'm a legislator. I'm a member of the South Carolina House of Representatives. I was elected by the people in my district in 2016, and I've been there ever since. And so what I do sort of on a daily basis is I visit a lot of, you know, businesses in my area, or, you know, other officials, local elected officials. I'll visit with them. Just a few weeks ago, I had a meeting, for example, with our sheriff's office and all of his people that directly report to him, to talk about what's going on in the jails. There's a lot of mental illness in the jails, so I've been working on a project there to help with that situation. And then we also talked about the prevalence of drugs in our county in South Carolina. So I'm having those sorts of meetings. I'm meeting with my staff. I'm the chair of the 3M committee, which is medical, municipal, and military affairs. And so I have a co-chair of that committee, and then I have 3 subcommittee chairs. So I've been meeting with them, talking with them about what we need to tackle next, and what sort of legislation we might want to file for next year, and what sort of money requests we think we might need to make, or how we can help serve the people in our districts. And, you know, there are a lot of opportunities out there to help. And so we always have plenty to talk about. So that's what I do on a day-to-day basis when I'm out of session. When we're in session, which in South Carolina is January through mid-May, you know, from Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, we're actually in session. I'm having committee meetings on either side of that. I'm talking to a lot of state agencies. If they've got legislation that's being debated that impacts them. I'm having a lot of conversations with them. I'm having a lot of conversations with other members of the General Assembly to help educate them on what might be coming through my committee. And honestly, I talk a lot with the lobbyists as well, because, for example, in medical affairs, right? I mean, I'm not educated to be someone in the healthcare business. I know really very, very little about it. So I have to rely a lot on lobbyists, which are hired by, say, the medical association. And that's just a whole group of doctors. So if I need to talk to doctors about, I don't know, about prior authorization, I was recently talking with that about that. So if I need to talk with doctors about prior authorizations, then I can go to that lobbyist and they can pull together some of their members for me to talk to. So they're actually a really good resource.
So how did you, and we'll get into like what your career history was, but how have you found going into politics? So like, I totally understand when you say that it's a calling, like that totally makes sense to me. I also like one of the things that I've thought about, because I've thought about this, like, because I think serving people is super important and helping make change is super important. I also am scared to death of all the haters out there that are on social media. Like, so how did you get into politics? Have you found that to be the case? Like, I mean, is it hard from a standpoint of like the people that you like, are there haters or is that just a perception? Because maybe I'm wrong in that. I don't know.
No, I wish it were a perception. No, there are haters and that's okay.
But are they mean? Yeah. Like, I mean, like some people seem so mean and actually like would make me, like, I think like fear for one's safety, especially as a woman. Is that?
Well, I mean, if you fear for your safety, then you need to contact law enforcement.
So you don't get like threats or anything like that, or like nothing like that. Nothing that makes you like.
No direct threats.
Okay.
I may see something on social media that borders on that, but I understand that people say things on social media that they would never say to your face. And in fact, I mean, I've talked with some people that vehemently disagree with me on social media. And I've actually picked up the phone and called them, or I've messaged them on Facebook. Please call me. I would love to hear your opinion on this. And I just take the approach that, you know, for the most part, all input is good input. We may still disagree at the end of the day, but I've heard and tried to understand your point of view, and you've heard and tried to understand mine. And there's something that's powerful in that, actually. And honestly, for our nation, there's something that's healing in that as well, right? Because we start seeing people as people again, not as just somebody on social media that we never, you know, have a chance to personally talk to or run into. So no, they're out there. You know, when I first got into politics, people told me you're going to have a thick skin. And I didn't at the time understand what that meant, but having been there for 7 years now, I mean, I understand. And you just have to get over that. You cannot let that bother you. You just can't. You can't let it bother you, because if you do let it bother you, then it interferes with your work. You just have to look at it as part of this wonderful process that we have in the United States. And it's just part of the process. And they get to say their opinion, and that's their right to do that.
Oh, I'm all for people saying their opinions. It's more of like the I don't know. I guess I've read things, especially about that have like targeted women that have kind of like deterred me from thinking about it, because it seems like some things that are said would make me concerned about my safety. But those are probably also maybe there's few of them and you just see them because they get brought out because of that. I don't know.
I mean, I think that is the case. I think that there aren't that many people out there like that.
That are that horrible?
Right. Yeah, okay. That are that horrible.
Okay, that's good to know.
And a lot of times those people that are that horrible are very vocal.
Yeah,
and,
okay.
And I mean, I've had people go to the newspaper about issues before. I would say don't let that deter you, because really there's nothing you can change about that. it just, that's the way it is. And, you know, I tried to, and I've done this from the very beginning, you know, I've had opponents in the past that were pretty tough on me. And I've had people tell me, you know, you need to fight back. And, you know, I just choose to sort of lead by example mm-hmm. and take the high road. I mean, at the end of the day, you have to do what's comfortable for you. And I have to do what's comfortable for me. It's really not in my nature to talk nasty about somebody.
And I think, you know, like talking about issues and having difference of opinions on issues is, that's fine. I mean, that's part of our political process. It's more like when it gets personal and the threats and stuff that I have read about that like women have had against them that have, I would say, like made me more concerned. It's more of those things, the things that are personal.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's out there. And some issues, as you know, some issues are harder than others.
Yeah.
Some are very tough.
Yeah.
And so I would say don't let that deter you. You know, if you feel a calling to serve, then you're going to have to find that way to serve. Otherwise, it's going to bother you.
that's good to know. How did you end up getting into politics? So you retired from Santee Cooper in 2014, correct? And we'll get into your career at Santee Cooper and stuff. So you retired and then you found your calling, new career a couple yeah. years later. What made you decide to go into politics after you had retired? Or was this something you've always wanted to do?
Well, you know, I've always been interested, right? I've always been interested. And at one point I did run for the school board and I lost because I ran for school board then. Because my children were in middle school and high school, and I wanted to be, you know, I was the mom that always, you know, brought cookies to school, read with the children, went on the field trips. I volunteered for everything. So I understood how important an education was for a child. And especially, I just felt like, you know, children, especially when they're young, they need good role models and they need people working with them to help them. So I thought that, well, maybe the next level in that is school board. I lost that. I didn't pursue it. Actually, it was, I think I missed a bullet because what happened shortly after that election was they found out our treasurer was embezzling money.
Oh,
yeah. So I was really, in retrospect, not really wanting to be a part of that. So so anyway, what happened after I retired is I started trying to figure out what I was going to do next. Right. So I cleaned out the garage, cleaned out all the junk drawers, remodeled the kitchen from the subfloor up. I looked into going to law school. I mean, all of these different things. And so I kept a journal about the things that I thought I might want to do. I took oil painting lessons, you know, I was like all over the board. Right. And, so I kept this list of the things that I wanted to do. And more than anything, I wanted to do something that mattered. I wanted mm-hmm. to do something to help people. I wanted to do something that made things better. And, you know, I wasn't going to get that fulfillment cleaning out the garage. So I figured that
hopefully
out.
That's not like a recurring thing that you have to continue doing all the time anyway.
Yeah, hopefully not. So so what happened was that the man who was my representative, he was charged with sexual harassment of our pages.
Oh,
yeah. And so he got into a little bit of trouble. He stepped down. And so he was no longer in office, but he was still on the ballot for the fall for the primary election. Well, maybe. No, I think it was just the general election. I don't think at that time he had any primary opponents. So he was still on the ballot. So what happened was there was a special election held to fill his position between the time that he left was about June timeframe to the end of the year. Well, session was already over. And so I started thinking, well, you know, do I file for this position or don't I, you know? So I called around some and people are saying, oh, it doesn't matter. It's an end. Session's already over. Nothing. It's, you know, everything's already done for the year. It's not going to matter. So I thought, you know, this just doesn't sit well with me, right? Mm-hmm. How can we not have a representative? I don't care how long it is. I want a representative every day of the week.
Yeah.
And so, so I you know, just thought about it, and it was last day of filing, last hour of filing, I drove over to the voters registration building and I said, well, if nobody's going to do this, I am. And so I went in and filled out the paperwork. And as it turned out, the state of South Carolina, the law said that if there's a special election and only one person files for that election and no one comes as a petition candidate within X number of days, then that person who filed for to run in a special election is deemed elected.
Oh, okay.
And so I was deemed elected. And guess what? Within the next week, I went with my family and we drove to Columbia. I had never been in the Capitol building before. We drove to Columbia. I walked in. We had a special session to take up Governor Nikki Haley's vetoes. And so I went in, I was sworn in by the Speaker of the House, and then I went to work, and all day long I was voting on Nikki Haley's vetoes of the state budget. And so so what happened was that not only did I start off busy, but I started getting emails and invitations, and, you know, I was the incumbent at that point. So I was treated as a legislator. And so by the time the election came around, the real election, right, came around, you know, I had someone that had filed against me. The man who was there before had dropped out. And so then I had a race that I had to run very shortly thereafter. So that's how I got in. And, you know, I look to my faith when I'm making a lot of major decisions. And so, I mean, I weighed heavily on my faith, and I prayed a lot before I went in and signed my name to the filing papers.
So you kind of like jumped in with both feet.
Yeah. Oh yeah, I absolutely did.
Wow. And how has it been? Like, how has your retirement career change been?
It's been wonderful. I wish that I had done this earlier, actually. But, you know, I mean, you graduate with a math degree and then go work in computer science, you know, and energy for a while. You know, you never think that that's going to lead to politics, right? And so, which, by the way, I have an opinion on that, too. You know, right now, energy issues and tech issues are huge.
Right.
And those are two issues that I can argue all day long. So it's kind of interesting that my background is actually directly applicable to politics right now.
So one of the things that I have thought, so you bring that up, and that makes me think about something that I have thought about this for a while. And I served on the reason that we actually got connected was through Tom Perry, who I knew through an industry trade association that we were on the board together on. And I got into doing advocacy on behalf of the trade association. I chaired their public policy division, went to like a lot of federal agencies, went to the Hill, which has been great, because at that time, like when this first came about, I had no interest in politics, and I'm like, I don't want to chair public policy division. That sounds awful. And it's so not like politics, for one. And it's, I think, such an important thing to do. And I didn't realize that at the time. I got to realize it by doing, which I think is kind of interesting. But I think what you bring up is really interesting, because if you're not there at the table, and you know, you like we as engineers or people in IT or with math or whatever, the technical degrees and those viewpoints and working in energy for, in your case, 31 years, we're relying on people who don't have that experience to make those decisions that are very, very important and that affect the lives of everybody and the, you know, and our energy companies to be able to do the best job that they can. And is that kind of what you mean by you wish you'd got into that? Like, I see such an importance, and I see a lack of involvement, which is then how I started thinking, well, like, you know, maybe that's something in the future for me, not super soon, but possibly something in retirement also. Like, that's kind of what I thought of.
I wish I'd gotten into it earlier, just because I really love it. I love the people aspect of it. I love solving problems. I love helping people. And I love the analytical nature of it, actually, because, you know, when you're getting together with a group and trying to solve a problem, especially if you have two sides or more that are dug into their position, you know, it's really fun, I think, and challenging to try to find that middle ground or try to find a way out, try to find a solution in spite of the fact that there are so many roadblocks. You know, so my analytical nature just sees that as a challenge, and it's a constant challenge. And not only is it a challenge, I see sort of my unique place in that as someone who comes from an analytical background and someone who's comfortable with problem solving. And so, yeah, I think it's just great fun. And you really get to meet some incredible people. And I'm not talking about, I mean, I've met Nikki Haley, I've met Tim Scott, I've met Trump, I've met our governor. You know, I'm not talking about those people necessarily, although, you know, they're all very interesting to meet. But I'm talking about, you know, the woman whose son was in high school, you know, committed suicide. I'm talking about the veteran that needs help, that, you know, in their older age, they, you know, can't find their way, you know, so it's always those people those are what really makes it rewarding. And there's nothing more frustrating than having someone come to me with an issue and I work and work and work, and there's just no way to fix it. I mean, I've had women who've contacted me, and they have husbands that are dying of cancer or dying of something else. And I'll work to try to help them do something. At the end of the day, you know, those things happen. And, you know, the doctors do all they can, and they get all the medical help that's available, but those things still happen. And so, I don't know, there have been some very rewarding things about it. And some very sort of sad situations. But, you know, I'm happy to do anything I can to help those people.
When you were talking about that, it's more of the ordinary people that mm-hmm. you talk to that are important and extraordinary. That's honestly like how I came up with the title of my podcast, because like it's talking with ordinary people that do extraordinary things. And I think we kind of forget that sometimes, how important they are and how extraordinary everyone is and how extraordinary every life is. And a lot of times we only hear from people who are famous or people that are, you know, out there. And there's so many incredible people and so many incredible stories. And I think it's so important to listen to people and be able to hear their stories or share their stories or, you know, whatever it might be.
That's right. Every person. And so, I mean, that's one thing that I think is so interesting about people in general, is that everybody's different. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of fun discovering what those differences are and, you know, understanding, you know, that person's place in the world. It's really interesting.
Well, I am grateful that you are out there working for the people of South Carolina and, you know, making that change and making that difference. I think it's so incredibly important and such really, really great work. So I'm thankful for that. I want to talk about, so you had 31 years at Santee Cooper and in different roles starting out in IT. Tell me about your career in Santee Cooper and how that progressed. Cause you started out in IT, but then you went on to managing nuclear contracts and managing, I think it was power supply contracts. And so tell me about how your journey throughout your career within Santee Cooper was.
Well, I started at Santee Cooper as a programmer. And at that time, Santee Cooper was hiring specifically COBOL programmers. I don't know if you remember COBOL. That, I think it was well before your time.
I did not take COBOL, but I also did not do programming. So the only programming I did was Fortran, because that was required in electrical engineering.
Right. So you know, I was hired as a COBOL programmer, and they were, Santee Cooper was just starting to write a new materials management system. And so I came in and I worked as a COBOL programmer for maybe 2 years or so. And then we had an area. So all of our work at that time was done on IBM mainframes.
Mm-hmm.
And so we had two IBM mainframes, two operating systems. All of the COBOL work was done on one machine with one operating system, MVS. I don't know if you're familiar with that at all. And so then I left that and went to work for, I was what they call a systems programmer. Instead of an applications programmer, I became a systems programmer, and I worked on the other mainframe. The operating system was on the other mainframe, which is VM, and which is stands for virtual machine, which actually, structurally speaking, it was a really, really cool operating system. And I have a lot of stories to tell about that in and of itself. But so I did that for a couple of years and really enjoyed that. That was a lot of fun. And then I ended up working on disaster recovery planning and then tech planning. I went into management and I managed the database administrators. And then I went on to manage the networking group. So I remember when we first installed firewalls.
Mm-hmm.
You remember that?
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Like the beginning of cybersecurity. So I was, you know, involved in all of that. And looking back on it, it's pretty interesting because I saw quite an evolution in computing from the time that I was first hired to the time that I left. And I was involved. I mean, if there was any department in IT, I was involved in it. So I ended up sort of like moving around a little bit. After about 20 or so years, I got a phone call and they were telling me, it was a secretary from upstairs, which is where, you know, all the executive management was. They said, CEO wants to see you. And I'm like, uh-oh, I am in big trouble.
It's like I can call to the principal's office.
I don't know what I did, so anyway, I went up there and he asked me, he said, well, you know, I'm going to move some people around. Would you like to be the manager of wholesale markets? And I said, well, and you'll get this. I don't know the difference between a megawatt and a megawatt hour. So I've got a lot to learn. And he's like, well, you know, I just need your management skills. So I said, okay. So I did that for a while. And so I had under that purview, the whole of the wholesale marketing group, fuel cost forecasting, load forecasting, generation planning, the contract. We administrated the contract that Santee Cooper had with VC Summer for the energy from two nuclear units. So, you know, we had that. We had some power supply agreements with a few municipalities, and that all of that was managed out of my little group. And so, yeah, I just kind of, you know, moved around from subject to subject. And as issues came up, I would take on different tasks or, you know, participate in different committees. And so I ended up learning a lot about the utility industry by the time I left. The only thing I really didn't understand was transmission, because at that time they were separating the transmission from the marketers.
Mm-hmm. Yep. I remember that.
Yeah. So I ended up not knowing a lot about transmission just because I wasn't allowed to do that.
Can't talk to those people.
Right.
It's like,
yeah, I know, exactly.
It's like they're the physical version of a firewall, right?
Right. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Yeah.
How did you find when you started out? Because I think you're maybe from like looking at your LinkedIn profile, you're maybe like 10 years older than me. How was it starting out as a female, both in programming and also in the utility industry at that time?
Well, oddly enough, being a math major, I was one of the very few female females that were in the, in, you know, mm-hmm. taking the higher level math classes.
Yep.
So, so I was a little bit used to that already, you know, when I, especially in systems programming, that was primarily men, networking, all of those sort of more hands-on kind of higher tech jobs. There were a lot of men in those jobs. There were a lot of men in the electric utility industry mm-hmm. in general.
Yep.
Honestly, it never really bothered me.
Were they welcoming? Did they was it fine? I mean, I came in as an engineer to my utility. I was the second female engineer, but I was the first one that ever went out in the field. And for the most part, like, I found people to be very welcoming and, you know, and super helpful, actually.
Me too.
For the most part. There were some definitely like some issues sprinkled throughout my career, but for the most part, I didn't necessarily find challenges either.
No, and I didn't either. And there was a time when we first started putting desktop computers on everybody's desk, right? I was going out to the generating stations mm-hmm. and installing all the computers. I mean, and honestly, they were glad to see me, and, you know, because I was going to give them some equipment that they needed. So mm-hmm. yeah, I always felt like they were very welcoming. I only had one situation that where somebody was touching me, not inappropriately, but they were going there, right? Mm. And he laid his hand on me, and I turned around and looked at him, and I said, "Get your hand off me." And that was it. That was all it took, you know? Probably from there, I had a reputation. I don't know. But, you know, I really didn't have a problem with it.
That's great.
I mean, there were many, many times that I sat in rooms around a boardroom table, and I just looked around and said, "Gee, I'm the only woman in
yeah.
here."
Yep.
But it didn't bother me, and you know, I sort of wore that as a badge of honor. Yeah, a badge of honor. Yeah, I did.
So no, I understand that, because it's like mm-hmm. you have, well, you know, and you talk about having to have a tough skin in politics. You probably start developing that tough skin as you're going through a career that is in that, you know, when you are the only woman in a room. I think like you start having, you start building a tough skin. So,
and that's okay. I think we can do that.
Yeah. Well, and I think, you know, like, I mean, I want things to be different. Like, I would like to not be the only woman in the room a lot of times.
You know? Yeah.
But I mean, and things are changing. I just wish they would change a little bit faster. I want the world to be a little bit better for my daughters, and there to be some more women out there. But anyway, so let's talk about math, because we were talking about this on the intro call, and like math is my favorite thing. I loved math. I always said if I wasn't an engineer, I would probably have taught calculus. I absolutely loved calculus. I miss doing math. I still miss doing math. I wouldn't do it just for the fun of it, but I kind of miss doing it. What got you into studying math for your undergrad degree? Like what brought you to study math?
Well, actually, it's very simple. I was probably better in math than anything else, and I wanted to graduate with a good GPA. And so I said, well, I'll just major in math.
Did you have any idea of like what you wanted to do with that at the time?
Well, no. What I really wanted to do was I wanted to be an architect.
Hmm. Wait, did we talk about this?
I don't know. Did we?
I don't think so, because I wanted to be an architect from third grade until my freshman year of college.
Yeah? Really?
Yes. Yes. Yeah, okay. Tell me about wanting to be an architect.
I'll tell the whole story then.
Okay.
Because, you know, I mean, I grew up drawing house plans, and I would dream about houses, and in mm-hmm. my dream, I would like walk through a house, and so I could like see everything. It was like I was creating in my sleep. And so, you know, at the time, you know, I was thinking about a couple of different things, and everything I really talked about, my parents, this is what my parents told me. They said, well, it doesn't really matter what you major in, because you only need a degree if your husband dies. Yeah. So, I mean, my parents, that's the way they looked, because, and I kind of understand it, because they wanted to make sure that I was secure and that my children were secure. And they thought that the best way to do that was to, you know, go and find a husband. So yeah, they were a little nervous. I think when I graduated, I didn't have a husband yet, but so, they, you know, they didn't encourage me. They didn't discourage me. So what I decided to do was to write a letter to Clemson University. Clemson's the only college in the state of South Carolina that has an architecture degree. So I decided I was going to write Clemson University and say, hey, I'd be interested in being in your architecture program. What can I do? So they ended up sending me a letter back and they said, well, what you need to do is contact the office, bring your drawings and your models, and then we'll go from there. We'll, you know, interview you. And I thought, well, that's great, except for the fact that my drawings are just sketches and I have no models and I don't know how to do a model, right?
And
that was before YouTube.
And this is high school to go into college?
Yes.
I don't know anybody in high school who had drawings or models for architecture.
No, they didn't.
That seems very strange.
So here's the rest of the story. About 20 years later, or maybe even more than that, I was talking to a man one night at like a reception or something. And I said, well, what do you do? He said, well, I'm an architect. Oh, I said, oh, that's cool. That's where I wanted to be. And I said, where'd you get your degree? Clemson. I'm like, oh, yeah, well, I tried getting into Clemson, but I didn't have any models or drawings. And he said, well, I didn't either. He said, look, you applied to the graduate college.
Oh.
He said that if you go to the graduate college, they require models and drawings, but not undergraduate.
Oh, okay. Okay, yeah. That makes sense. Okay. So would you have gone into architecture if you hadn't got that letter?
I probably would have. Yeah.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, I know. I still love buildings.
Me too. So I got to tell you, like, my kids, I feel like I had like a really interesting way about wanting to be an architect. So between second and third grade of elementary school, there was a program that, I don't know what they call, like, for like gifted students or accelerated students, whatever they called it. And my teacher in second grade had me go to this camp. It was a 1 week day camp between second and third grade during the summer. We shadowed a professional. I happened to shadow a woman architect. This would have been like 1980, probably. Like, when I think back on this, I'm like, what are the odds of me having shadowed a woman architect in 1980 as a second grader? Like, that is just crazy. And she had me draw like my dream house, you know, during that week and that I was shadowing her and stuff. And so for me, from that time on, I wanted to be an architect. And I kept getting told, like, well, you need to have, like, you need math and you need science to be an architect. And I loved math. I loved science, all good things. I took drafting in high school. And then I went to architecture school and it was all art. Like, it was like, go sketch buildings, go build something out of sticks and stones and then sketch it. And there was no math and science. And I had actually had to have, like, I had to apply separately to the School of Architecture within the university that I went to. I had to have higher ACT scores in math than I did to, like, get into, like, the regular university. Mm-hmm. And there was, like, hardly any math and science. And so mm-hmm. I ended up changing majors because I had this viewpoint that I sucked at art. I have a whole different viewpoint on that now. But, and so that's how, so I ended up, like, switching because there wasn't math. It was so much art. And I'm like, I wanted to be in math. But I still have this dream. Like, I want a timber frame house. Like, that is like my dream, is a frame house.
Right.
And so
right.
I still have this goal. And, you know, I'm approaching probably the end of me like having new houses. Mm-hmm. I still have a goal of building my own timber frame house and being able to like design my own house. So I'm still hoping to get there. But that's so interesting.
It's funny that you say that. So recently I've been looking at property in the mountains of North Carolina to do either that, or they've got these awesome prefab houses now
mm-hmm.
that are made out of, it looks like aluminum and that's been painted. Or I don't know, maybe it's part of the product, the metal itself, but, and then cedar or something like that.
Oh,
these really, really cool. They're really, really cool modular houses. They're probably cost a fortune. They probably cost the same amount as if you built it because they're very highly designed. You can tell. But yeah, I was just looking at that. And, you know, I have never built my own house. I've always bought something that, you know, already existed. So, I mean, I would just love to build one house.
Yeah. Well, so we've been looking at property for retirement on the North Shore of Lake Superior in Minnesota. So I live in Minnesota. And so kind of the same thing. I'm assuming that's probably like similar to like the mountains of North Carolina, like very scenic. And I can't afford to live on the shore of Lake Superior because that's just like ridiculously expensive. But so we could have a view of Lake Superior would be my goal in my timber frame house. If I could do like my ideal, my dream house, that would be my dream house. Now we'll see. I don't know. I may never get there either. So,
anyway, I majored in math because it was easy for me and I could make good grades.
Okay.
That was the reason.
what did your parents do? I'm just curious, especially like with their advice.
They were entrepreneurs.
Okay.
My father owned his own business. My grandfather, my whole family was small business owners.
Okay.
And my father had 3 heart attacks before he was about 35.
Oh my gosh.
And I think that played a role in them being so concerned about, you know, what would happen to me or what would happen to my sister, you know, if we didn't have a way to support ourselves. So, but anyway, I've told my sons to, you know, go and do what you think you're supposed to be doing, no matter how hard it seems, no matter what. And so I've sort of done the opposite with mine. And told him, look, you know, you go be whatever you want to be. So now I have a son in the Army, and then I have a son who's in college, and he's majoring in history because he knows more about history than anybody I've ever met in my life, and he's minoring in Russian.
Oh wow, that sounds very interesting. I think like where our inspirations and our ideas about like what to do come, you know, where they come from, who influences, either good or bad, right? Like, I mean, you can have, and I think like for me, like one of the reasons I loved math so much, I had great math teachers, like, you know, starting in second grade, fifth grade, 11th grade, and my senior year of high school, but I was taking college calculus at the college at the time. It was like PSEO had just spun up at that time, but it was all of those people that like made it fun, you know, and I think that can be like such a difference in what we study or don't study or want to study or don't want to study. And, but I think it's interesting where people's inspirations come from.
And I do think that if you're good at something, you should definitely explore just doing it, right? Because I think that we're all given unique talents. We all have unique talents. And for someone to not do what they're good at, just, you know, I don't know, just seems a little sad.
Yeah. As long as it's something they enjoy. And I think, think that that's something that's hard, you know, like there was not, I don't remember there being talk when I was thinking about what I wanted to do for a job about there being joy at work, you know, like I don't think that was something that was ever discussed of like, oh, you should do something that makes you happy, that you enjoy doing. Fortunately for me, like I went down a path. I've loved my career. Like I am, you know, like I still love architecture. I loved being an engineer. I've had a great career. Like there's not anything but there was not any discussion. It was more like you can have a good salary. You can, you know, take care of yourself. There wasn't anything about like, does this bring joy? I mean, it has. But when I talk to my kids, and I've got 2 daughters, 125, 121, and then a son that's 18. A lot of the discussions we have are, you know, like what does make you happy? What does bring you joy? And I think those conversations have changed. I don't know that it's necessarily 100% good or bad. You know, like I think there's some importance in having joy. There's always also some importance in having a life that you can, you know, having like reliable work, I think that's an important thing too.
Right. And hopefully, ideally you have both.
Or you have something that you work at and you have a passion and that you do on the side. Like that can be something too. I don't know. It's interesting. And I still struggle with what advice to give my kids. I mean, two of them are done with college, so we're kind of past that point. But hopefully I gave them good advice. I don't know. Yeah. I mean, and they're themselves, they don't necessarily follow in my footsteps. So I don't know. Parenting, I think, is interesting. What have you found to be most rewarding in your careers? I'm going to put an S on there, because either on your side on in the energy space or in the political space.
Well, I would say that as of right now, what's been most rewarding, I think, is sort of seeing how my career of 30 years at an electric utility has translated into what I'm doing now. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's so rewarding to sort of see, just like cybersecurity, right? I mean, I've seen that develop over the years to the point where we are now. And I think it's been rewarding to be able to take all that experience, which, who ever thought that all of that experience would be directly applicable to politics and government. But it's been very rewarding to see all of that work and all of that training and all of that experience. Actually, it's something that I can use, and I can lead certain discussions on certain topics. So I would say that's been very rewarding. And then, of course, it's just about all the little things you do too. Helping somebody get their unemployment check, or all of those sort of little things, I think all add up. And I think all of that's very rewarding as well.
What about the most frustrating on either side?
Ooh, the most frustrating is things don't get done quick enough. And some of that's by design, right? Because, we want to make sure that if we're changing law, that we're being very thorough and careful about it, right? But it's not always necessary to drag things out as much as we do. So, whenever I put myself to a task, it usually comes with a to-do list. Whether I've written that or not, I've got a to-do list in my head. And so I'm there to accomplish certain things and to get things done, right? I'm not there to, enjoy the political part of it and be a part of that. I'm there to get things done and make things happen. So it's frustrating when things don't move quickly enough. I would say, that's one of the most frustrating things. And then some things are just common sense, right? And a lot of times you'll come up to a situation and it'll just be common sense to do one thing, but you have to go through all these gyrations to actually get it done. But there again, that relates back to, a to-do list and wanting to check things off and make sure you get things done.
So you mentioned how things move slowly, somewhat by design. And does it help coming from the utility industry in that? Because things move pretty slowly in the utility industry too, also by design, right? Like you don't want to make any changes that are going to cause people's lights to go out, right? Like we're very slow and methodical in the energy industry to make sure that we have reliable power. Does that help at all going into government? Because the only industry that I have seen to move slower than the utility industry is probably government.
Right. Well, it does help. And that's funny that you say that, because with an integrated resource plan, for example, right, mm-hmm. you're looking out 35 to 40 mm-hmm. years.
Yep.
And so you're trying to predict within some margin of error, right? You're trying to predict what the load's going to be, what energy efficiency we might see by that point, the price of natural gas, the price of coal, the availability of nuclear, and whether or not we're going to be able to put small modular reactors in there at some point. So you're trying to predict all of that. And I mean, it's a moving target, as you probably know. There's no way to come up with a plan that's going to exactly happen the way you lay it out. And I would say in government, sometimes things move slowly, but you're working towards a bigger endpoint, you know, something that's, you know, well, I mean, I think in government, sometimes we're too short-sighted, right? We make decisions today that affect people for the next 2 years until, you know, everybody comes up for re-election in two years.
Yeah.
But we really need to be thinking. And I think, you know, I think topics such as national security play into this, right? I mean, you have to play the long game. You need to think about where the United States is going to be, for example, 50 years from now. And I said where it's going to be, I mean, like economically speaking, you know, where we stand in relation to other world powers. So if you've got to look out 50 years for the United States, you also need to be looking out 50 years for every other country, every other large country in the world that can impact the United States. So I say things move slowly, but a lot of times it's just getting to that next step. But what worries me is that we don't necessarily do all of that long-term planning. I'm hoping that there's somebody that in federal government that's working on that, but that concerns me. And I think utilities, you know, we're used to dealing with that. We're mm-hmm. used to, right? We're used to having that big plan in mind, knowing that the big plan can change depending on what happens that influences that. So we've got the big plan in mind. And so that we're slowly building that transmission system, for example, to meet that load that's going to be out there in 20 years.
Right, right.
So it's similar, I think, in that regard.
So we need some long-term planning at the government level.
Yes. Yeah.
It sounds like really great.
We absolutely do.
Advice.
even just in the energy sector, right? So, you know, not too long ago, nuclear was out of favor, right? Now everybody and their brother wants a small modular reactor. And I'm thinking to myself, well, we had planned on that 10 years ago, which we could have planned on, mm-hmm. right? Yep. We wouldn't be in sort of the mess that we're in now. You know, the country is going to need energy and capacity in the very, very near future.
And unless we can figure out energy storage, solar and wind can't meet that.
No, they can't.
Everyone likes their lights when the wind's not blowing and when there is no sunshine.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah.
That's right.
It's clean. I mean, that's the frustrating part with nuclear. I mean, unless you have an incident, nuclear is very clean.
Mm-hmm. It is.
That could be a whole other podcast discussion.
So, you know, any argument against nuclear would be about the fuel rods that still have fuel in them. So if we ever figure out that situation, if we ever figure out how to recycle those fuel rods and get every bit of the energy out of them, then that's a huge hurdle.
Yeah, there's a lot. Is there anything that we haven't talked about today that you want to share?
One thing that I want to talk about is Million Women Mentors. Have you ever heard of that?
I have not. Sounds interesting.
So it's a national organization of women in STEM. And, you know, their focus is on encouraging young girls and young ladies to be involved in STEM classes, K through 12, encourage them to go into STEM careers. And then for those women that are in STEM careers, we encourage them to remain in those careers.
Mm-hmm. Very important.
Yeah, it is. Mm-hmm. It is. And we want all women, right, to know that those jobs are for them as well.
Yep.
That education is there for them, that those robotics classes and the first robotics. Are you familiar with that?
I am. Yeah, my son did Lego League in the first robot. Yeah, he did. So yes,
that's wonderful. That's a wonderful program. So it's called.
You need my girls in it. To your point.
Yeah. So there are Million Women Mentors is at a national level. And then we also have a Million Women Mentors in South Carolina. I don't know that all states have a state organization.
I'll do some checking on that and put it in the episode notes.
I'm an honorary chair of the South Carolina Million Women Mentors. And, I'm happy to be involved in that.
I will put links to resources for that too. That sounds amazing. That is honestly, the core of why I do this podcast is encouraging girls and young women to go into STEM, keep them there, keep women feeling supported, build community. So that at some point, we're not one woman at a table of men,
But if we are, that's okay too.
That's okay too. But to try to encourage so that girls feel like, and that's, I think, like one of the things that I have to be careful with, and I had to be careful with this with my daughters too. These are things that girls and women can do, not that they have to do, right? Like it's an option. It is not a, right?
Right.
Not everyone has to go into STEM, but we want those who want to go into STEM or to be able to know about STEM so that, that they know that it's for them.
Also, one other thing, when I first was elected, I was given some advice to find a topic or something that I was passionate about and that I could sort of lead on. And so I decided, I'm very passionate about STEM education. And so one thing I would like to do is create a STEM day at the Capitol.
Mm.
So I got in contact with Tom Peters, who's the director of the South Carolina Coalition for Math and Science. And I said, Tom, I'm thinking about having a STEM education day at the Capitol building. What do you think about that? He said, that's wonderful. And I said, is that something that you can help me with? He said, oh, yeah, I can do that. So I very early on found somebody that agreed with me and got on board with me. And so we've now gone from having a STEM education day at the Capitol where we had students from all over the state bring their robots and they were in the Capitol building. I had the governor come out looking and all that. And so we've gone from STEM education day to STEM education week. And now we have STEM education month.
Oh, wow.
Where there are STEM activities all throughout the month, including STEM day at the Capitol.
Oh, I love that.
So they still come to the Capitol. They don't necessarily always bring their robots. They've done something different every year, but so we're still doing that.
Oh, that's absolutely awesome.
I'm proud of that.
That's so great. Yeah, I love that. There needs to be more of that in other states. I don't know how many states have that. I have no idea if my state has that. One of the things I will say, though, that my state has that I am glad for is that they have a requirement that engineering, at least engineering concepts, have to be taught in school starting in kindergarten. Like I had no idea what an engineer was or anything about engineering, even when I was going to school to be an engineer. So I think those kind of requirements are really, things are changing. It's great to see things change.
I'm filing a bill that requires that computer programming be part of the curriculum for K through 12.
Oh, awesome.
Somebody tried that a couple of years ago. It didn't fly at that point. So I'm refiling it to see if we can do that. Because when I talk to groups of people, what I tell them is that if you give a baby something that they've never seen before, you put them in a high chair, give them something that they've never seen before, what do? They look at it. They bite it, they shake it, right? And then they throw it. Mm-hmm. But that's the baby's innate ability to try to go through an analytical approach to figure out what this new object.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that children are born with those analytical abilities. And honestly, I think in some cases, we've taught that out of them. We teach them in a manner that doesn't encourage that sort of analytical thinking. So, I mean, I think we're seeing that turn around here in the U.S., but I think we need to make a deliberate point of nurturing that K through 12.
For sure. I've also heard about people trying to get computer languages to be kind of viewed in the same way of like there's a requirement at some schools for languages themselves of getting like computers, you know, computer languages to be included in that like segment of languages.
Right. Yeah. I like that.
So, yeah, I think it's super important. And I think that also helps with girls' inclusion. Like I tried to get my daughters to go to take coding classes and they're like, well, no, my friends aren't taking it. If you have a requirement, everyone's taking it. That takes that whole social pressure out of it.
That's right. It does. You're right.
So I think that's awesome. I hope it's successful.
Yeah, I do too.
I've just absolutely enjoyed talking with you. The one thing that I do like to end my podcast with is what advice would you give to girls or young women or really like anyone, like any advice? Because I think that you have a wealth of advice that is not, I think, just for girls going into STEM. What kind of advice would you give?
Speak up, speak out, and have confidence in yourself.
Super, super, super great advice. I have absolutely loved talking with you. And I thank you so much for being on the podcast. I'm so glad that Tom connected us. Like I've just absolutely had such a great time talking with you. And
yeah, I'm glad he connected us too.
Yeah, me too. And if you come to Minnesota, and which I would not recommend for probably like the next 6 months, it gets very cold and disgusting here for the next 6 months. We have a beautiful place in the summertime though. Let me know. We get coffee up here. So if you ever come up this way.
All right. That sounds good.
All right. And just keep in touch too. If you know, I would love to keep in touch with you.
And if you want to talk further about, going into office, running for office, call me because I can give you all kinds of advice about actually the running part, what it's like to actually run for office and who you need to call, what you need to do because yeah.
Okay. I appreciate that. I might.
Okay.
Still, it's still a thought back here, but it's something that I think it's important.
Oh, wait, I'm going to go back for a minute.
Okay.
The list that I was coming up with, when I said that I was sort of between my job at Santee Cooper and my work in the legislature,
yeah.
I was sort of writing a list.
Yeah.
Well, after I was elected, I had stuck that list in my night drawer, mm-hmm. my bedside table drawer. Mm-hmm. And so when I went back, I was cleaning out that drawer and I found that list. And it was stuff like work at a food bank, help children with their education. All of the things that I listed that were sort of altruistic in nature, but mm-hmm. I realized, right, that as a legislator, I can do all of those
things. You're just upstream.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's amazing. So,
yeah. So I was like, wow, I'm doing everything that I wanted to do. And I'm not doing them directly. But I'm creating legislation or creating a means for other people to go do that.
And doing it upstream so that there's hopefully less things that need to be done downstream.
Yeah.
At some point.
Yeah. Yeah. So I meant to go full circle with that story about writing everything down, but I didn't do that.
So you got to cross off a lot of things on your to-do list.
Yes, exactly. Exactly.
That's awesome.
And yeah. Yeah. It's pretty good. I enjoy it.
Yeah, that's great. All right. Well, thank you. And again, I just thank you for being in public office and serving. Cause I think it's something that
thank you.
Is really, it's such important work.
Yeah.
I'm sure it's not easy.
Well, but it's rewarding. So it makes up for the times where it's not easier, cause it can get kind of hectic.
All right. Well, thank you so much. And I look forward to keeping in touch.
Yeah, me too. Thank you. Have a good day.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye.
I hope you enjoyed this episode and Celeste's story. If you enjoyed this episode, I'd like to ask you to do a couple things, which are really important to get these women's stories to more people and increase representation of women in STEM. First, share an episode you like with a friend. Second, go to the podcast platform you listen on and rate my podcast. Or even better, please write a review. Third, subscribe or follow my podcast by going to your favorite podcast platform and click the plus or follow button. That way, you'll never miss an episode. And lastly, you can find me, Kathy Nelson, at www.ordinarily-extraordinary.com or email me at ordinarilyextraordinarypod@gmail.com. You can also find me on Facebook, Instagram, and LinkedIn, where you can find me by searching for my podcast. Please reach out to me. I hope to connect with you. And please join me for future episodes. Thank you.